Mysteries and challenges of birth, life and death. Becoming a new human being. Chapter 8. Acquiring the resurrection body. Reflection. As a person, you are extremely vulnerable. From one moment to the next, you may fall prey to rapid aging, injury, illness, and death. In the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus says, "There was a rich person who had a great deal of money. He said, 'I shall invest my money so that I may sow, reap, plant, and fill my storehouses with produce, that I may lack nothing.' These were the things he was thinking in his heart, but that very night he died. Anyone here with two ears had better listen." From the Gospel of Thomas, Logion 63. When you are deeply aware of your own mortality, you can discover what you really find important, and then give attention to that. It is tempting to repress the thought of an end to your life, because it feels uncomfortable, and you want to enjoy the time that you have been given as much as possible. You want to live from the motto, "Carpe diem," seize the day, or in other words, "Let us eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow we may die." It is excellent to enjoy life, but when all your time, attention and energy go in that direction, the soul languishes, because it wants to be nurtured and to grow stronger. From this insight, we can well understand the rhetorical question that Jesus poses to his disciples. "For what shall a man be profited if he shall gain the whole world and forfeit his life?" In Europe, in the Middle Ages, people reflected more on the inevitability of death than they do today. People died relatively young and more visibly as a result of illness, famine, cold, violence, and inadequate medical assistance. Christian faith strongly contributed to the fact that the motto "Memento Mori," "Remember, you must die," had a prominent place in the consciousness in the Middle Ages. Around the year 1500, the text of the play Elkerlijk appeared in print in the Netherlands, which, like the English version with the name Everyman, refers indeed to everyone. Death plays an essential role in this morality play, written in rhyme. The important messages in this short but profound story are that we are all mortal, that after the death of our body, we have to take responsibility for the life we lived, and that we would do well to live a pure life here and now. At that time, the text of Elkerlijk and theatre performances that were made of it were extremely popular. It touched people much more than a general philosophical reflection on death, because they recognized themselves in the main character of Elkerlijk. In the story, we recognize the way of the hero, with his development, as described by Joseph Campbell. The protagonist first leads a normal life, then at a given moment experiences difficulties, next receives an assignment, and is faced with trials in which he must persevere. If he accepts this, he receives help, which he experiences as grace. And thus a transformation takes place, which leads to a new state of being on a higher spiral of life. The protagonist, Elkalik, every man, represents man in general. He doesn't lead a very morally upright life, but rather lives from hand to mouth, perhaps similar to the prodigal son in the parable of Jesus, who also wasted his wealth in a life of excess. Such a person has become entangled in illusions and is stunned when death visits him and says that God wants to close his account and that he must prepare to make his last journey. Elkalik does not want to balance his account at all, and even less depart from earth. That is why he first tries to bribe death. He does not succeed, but he is allowed to take someone with him on his journey. Well, first he invites company. Company promises to come along, but when it turns out that Elkalik is not going to a party, but to the grave, she hastily departs. Elkalik subsequently receives a similar reaction from family and from possession. He then finally asks Virtue to come with him. She would indeed like to accompany him, but unfortunately she is far too ill and weak for the journey. And Virtue advises Elkalik to ask her sister Knowledge. Knowledge confronts Elkalik with his depravities and urges him to examine himself thoroughly and to turn to God. He does this, and because of this, Virtue is cured, which enables her to accompany Elkalik. Virtue then encourages Elkalik to also ask wisdom, beauty, and power to come along on this journey. And Knowledge advises to also invite the five senses. Elkalik makes his will, and they all set out together. When they come close to the realm of death, Beauty decides not to continue and goes her own way. Later, Strength also gives up and leaves him. Finally, Wisdom, as well as the five senses, also abandon Elkalik. But he is now not afraid anymore, and quotes, full of confidence and with complete surrender, the last words that Jesus exclaimed from the cross, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Virtue and Knowledge remain with Elkalik and are allowed to escort him when an angel comes to fetch him with the words, Come, chosen bride, up here and hear the sweet sounds of angels. Thanks to your virtue, bride, I'll take the soul out of your body. Her tally now is pure and clean, and I shall bring her to the court of heaven's hall, where all shall be together seen, the great ones and the small. Thus ends the story of Elkalik, a very ordinary person who lives his life just like everyone else. He has no distinction or specialty. At one point he is troubled by death, personified here and comparable to Arcanum 13 of the Tarot. Just as in the Tarot, death in this story stands not only for the discarding the physical body, but specifically for the transformation that will take place when the human being awakens inwardly. Elkalik is frightened by the visit of death, just as Christian Rosenkreuz is frightened by the angel who hands him the invitation to the royal wedding and leaves with a blast on her trumpet. Elkalik must also go on his journey but he wants to take with him everything that he has received or acquired in his earthly life. However, that is not possible. Those who want to enter the new field of life must gradually leave behind all that hinders them on his path. That is why Jesus said to the rich young man who asked him how he could obtain eternal life, "If thou wouldest be perfect, go, sell that which thou hast, and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven. And come, follow me." Attachments associated with companions, family, possessions can indeed be hindrances on the Gnostic Christian path. That is why the pupil of the soul, symbolized by Alkalik, must let these attachments go, though without foregoing the responsibilities that are bound up with them. Only after these purifications does Alkalik meet virtue, the as yet insignificant glow of the newly awakened spirit spark. The force emanating from the center of the microcosm is still weak. Virtue is therefore ailing, but can be cured thanks to the advice of a sister, knowledge, meaning inner knowledge or gnosis. This Gnostic knowledge relates to the deep self-knowledge of which the ancients said, "He who knows himself knows the all," and about which Jesus said, "If those who lead you say to you, 'See, the kingdom is in heaven,' then the birds of heaven will go before you. If they say to you, 'It is in the sea,' then the fish will go before you. But the kingdom is within you, and it is outside of you. When you know yourselves, then you will be known, and you will know that you are the sons of the living Father. But if you do not know yourselves, then you are in poverty, and you are poverty." From the Gospel of Thomas, Low John 3. Virtue, in the story of Alkalik, does not refer primarily to certain positive qualities, such as those known as the seven virtues, but to the Christ principle that can awaken in the heart through the Christ radiations, also referred to as the blood of the Lamb. And when that happens, certain qualities develop in the personality that can be used on the path, and which in Alkalik are referred to as wisdom, beauty, power, and the ability to consciously work with the five senses. We can see this development as a renewal and a dynamization of the personality through successfully the mental body, the astral body, the ether body, and finally the physical body. At death, those qualities cannot be taken with us over the threshold of death. They will at that moment be released via the dissolved blood soul, which can then become available to spiritually aspiring people on earth. The titles of the reflection texts in this book are themes that we can also recognize in the story of Alkalik. 1. Accepting the Word. Alkalik is at first fully absorbed in the sensory world and has forgotten his calling. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. Death awakens him from his symbolic sleep, and thus he realizes that he lives in sin. that he is not sailing the right course, and that he therefore misses the true purpose of his life. He is informed that he shortly has to make a pilgrimage, because that is part of the plan of God, the Word. Initially, he struggles against this because his ego does not want to go at all. But later, he realizes that it is inevitable. And like John the Baptist, he prepares to straighten his paths for his Lord. 2. Incarnating on earth. Like Moses, Elkelig realizes through this extraordinary encounter that he was born to fulfill an assignment, to lead the aspects of his inner being, his people, from slavery in the sensory world to the freedom of the children of God. 3. Fathoming cycles. Like Ecclesiastics, Elkelig experiences through his encounter with death that everything that begins at some point also must come to an end, and that it is therefore important during one's life to pay attention to that which is eternal. 4. Coping with loss. Job lost his children and his possessions. Elkelig notices that companions, possession, and family cannot join him on his journey, that he has to say goodbye to them inwardly. 5. Making the two into one. Elkelig goes on his pilgrimage through a threefold process of awareness, purification, and renewal. His soul becomes pure and powerful, so that he can celebrate his wedding in Cana. His soul is invited as the bride to unite with the bridegroom, the Spirit. 6. Using your talents. When the inner lamp of Elkelig burns as virtue, he receives true self-knowledge, and on that basis he receives the talents that he must use for his Lord: wisdom, beauty, power, and the five senses. 7. Becoming free from illusion. Elkelig discovers that he lives in illusion and experiences that he can be released from it on the basis of virtue, by paying attention to the light of the kindled spirit spark. And 8. Acquiring the resurrection body. During the pilgrimage of Elkelig, an imperishable spiritual body develops. He weaves a wedding garment for his spiritual wedding that is detached from the body when it is completed, the inner descent from the cross, so that it can ascend and live in the forecourt of heaven. Elkelig has gone the path through the mysteries, and may therefore look forward with confidence to the death of his physical body, because in him a spiritual body has been raised, in accordance with the joyful vision that Paul paints for us. For this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality. But when this corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then shall come to pass the saying that is written, "Death is swallowed up in victory." From 1 Corinthians. In the days when the play of Elkelig appeared, the population had great fear of death. The church told them that they should focus on good works, penance, confession, because only then could their sins be forgiven could they enter heaven after their death. And anyone who doubted the purity of his soul and was afraid of ending up in hell could buy so-called indulgences at extortionate prices, through which sins were forgiven and a comfortable place in heaven assured. Well, the reformer Martin Luther quite rightly denounced the practice of indulgences in the thesis he nailed to the door of the castle church in Wittenberg in 1517, with which he wanted to provoke an academic debate, though not a church reform. However, Luther is still seen as the spiritual father of the movement of the Reformation, which arose from the Renaissance area and later became a major impetus for progress. The Reformation stimulated individual responsibility and led to the relationship between God and man being rethought and reworded. The ideas of the Reformation are often summarized in the five Latin terms, the solas, that are presented as a unit since the 20th century. Sola Scriptura, only through the Scriptures. Sola Gratia, only through grace. Sola Fide, only through faith. Solus Christ, only through Christ. And Soli Deo Gloria, only to God the glory. Great truth can be found in these solas. They have contributed to people no longer letting themselves be led by fear of death, but receiving strength from a sense of grace. Unfortunately, the solas are also often rendered absolute, causing fundamentalism, fanaticism, short-sightedness, division, and the consequent unpleasant conflicts. The five solas were formulated at that time to answer the very pressing question of when one can be sure that he is saved and when not. From a universal perspective, that question is irrelevant, because the primary concern is that as human beings we must live in such a way that the inviolable glory of God, Dei Gloria Intacta, will be manifested in the soul. If that fails in one lifetime, the microcosm will experience as many rebirths and as much guiding help as needed until it succeeds. That is a comforting thought, but it is not intended that we postpone going the narrow path. Procrastinating behavior does not always have to be negative, because it can also mean that an inner maturation process is still going on. On the path of the disciple of the soul, it is primarily about being faithful to one's deepest inner self, who wants to reveal itself more and more, called virtue in Alkalik, and to grow to an ever-expanding inner knowing, portrayed as knowledge in Alkalik. And on the basis of virtue and knowledge emanating from the awakened spirit spark, forces can be attracted that perform the transfiguration. That is an alchemical conversion in which the new, incorruptible human being comes into being, the last Adam, in whom male and female are united. In the terminology of Paul, a spiritual body has then been erected, and the living soul has merged into the life-giving spirit. The healing process mentioned is grand and far-reaching and requires time and attention. Why should we be punished if we cannot accomplish it in one life? Or can we trust in the promise that God will not let go the works of His hand? We are known and we are guided. And if we open ourselves to this higher level guidance, we may experience it as it was once sung by the psalmist. O Jehovah, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my downsitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thoughts afar off. Thou searchest out my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Jehovah, thou knowest it altogether. Thou hast beset me behind and before, and laid thy hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain to it. Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. Psalm 139. The Lord is with us also in the realm of the dead, and we are guided by members of the divine hierarchy. How is it there on the other side of the veil of death? Many people think that this question is not relevant because it is only important what we do with our current life here on earth. Our life here and now is indeed important, but if we would have some understanding of life after death, we would shape our lives differently and above all more purposefully. Many people who have had a near-death experience live a very different life after this event, according to scientific research. They attach less importance to their possessions, power, fame, and become more sensitive, milder, more spiritual. In ancient mystery schools, it was deemed important that the students of the mysteries were informed with regard to life after death based on their own experiences. It was recognized that most people were not ready for this knowledge, and that is why only students who were demonstrably ready for it were admitted to this experience. At a certain high-level initiation in the process of the splitting of the personality, the pupil was put to sleep with certain drugs by a priest, the sleep lasting for 3.5 days. And during that initiation sleep, the astral body of the student of the mysteries was detached from the physical body, and he had, in full consciousness, access to all strata of the astral sphere. He could descend into the hellish levels, as well as ascend into the heavenly spheres. When he was awakened from his initiation sleep by the priest after about 84 hours, he was an initiate who had acquired first-hand knowledge of the mysteries of life and death and understood the phenomenon that we know as microcosmic reincarnation. The teachings on reincarnation were part of the mysteries in ancient times and were taught only to pupils in the mystery schools, who had to remain silent about them. Rudolf Steiner considers the so-called revival of Lazarus from the dead, described in the 11th chapter of the Gospel of John, as an initiation that Jesus performed. Lazarus had been lying in a grave in a cave for 3 days, but was not dead, as the story suggests, but asleep. According to Steiner, Jesus performed an old-style initiation with Lazarus, which would become later obsolete due to the mystery of Golgotha. The tearing of the veil in the temple at the time of Jesus' death is symbolic of the fact that humanity can, from that time on, go the mystery path in self-authority, without direct guidance from priests, the way of the cross to the eternal home. And what about the resurrection of Jesus? His spiritual resurrection body had been ready well before his death on the cross, in accordance with a remark in paragraph 17 of the Gospel of Philip. Those who say that the Lord died first and then rose up are in error, for he rose up first and then died. If one does not first attain the resurrection, he will not die. Jesus had overcome death long before he was put to death in a humiliating way. In fact, the Christ Spirit had already bonded with him at the time of his baptism in the River Jordan. Max Heindel writes that the violent death of Jesus, in which much blood was shed, was necessary because it enabled the Christ Spirit to withdraw swiftly from the body of Jesus without hindrance of the impurities of that human vehicle. Most biblical historians agree that the death on the cross of Jesus has indeed taken place, but they are divided on the matter of the resurrection, understandably because there is no convincing historical evidence that a dead body has ever come alive again. In earliest Christianity, images of the crucifixion are often of a spiritual, metaphorical nature. Paul, for instance, talks about the crucifixion of the old man, through which the new man can come to resurrection. He writes, "They that are of Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with the passions and the lusts thereof." And how may we see the appearances of the resurrected Jesus of which the sacred writings speak? Little to nothing indicates that in earliest Christianity, the resurrection of Jesus was understood as a physical resurrection. Paul names a number of apostles to whom the risen Christ appeared, and he is himself the last one on this list. His description of this encounter with Christ leaves little room for the concept of a physical encounter with a resurrected Jesus. Church fathers in the 2nd and 3rd century left room for a belief in a physically materialized form of Jesus. According to them, his resurrection body was densified into a figure his physical body had before his death, in which he could thus physically show himself to his disciples. They thought a resurrection in the old flesh to be absurd. Historical research shows that the doctrine of the atoning sacrifice, on which outer Christianity largely relies, cannot be upheld when traced back to the teachings of Jesus and earliest Christianity. This dogma, which teaches that Jesus took on all the sins of humanity through his death on the cross, and that every human being who believes in him is saved by this, was certainly a treasured concept in history, but can now be an obstacle to a further spiritual development of humanity. Fortunately, though, there is such a thing as a forgiveness of debts. Jacob Boehme writes about this doctrine. Sin is like a shell out of which the new man grows, and he then throws the shell away. And this is called forgiveness. This reminds us of the butterfly crawling out of his cocoon, abandoning it to fly to freedom. James writes in his letter, "For as the body, apart from the spirit, is dead, even so faith, apart from works, is dead." And Paul writes to the church of Philippi, "Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." These statements make it clear that a passive attitude toward faith is not recommended. The expression fear and trembling has nothing to do with fear. Fear means here awe, trembling, so that the lofty vibrations of grace are experienced physically. The word salvation refers to the state of being in which the person concerned is a spirit-inspired person, and thus transformed into a new person. Other Bible translations use the word glory, deliverance, or redemption instead of the word salvation. And those indications are also correct, provided these terms are correctly understood. Salvation, redemption, and glory do not refer to a deliverance from being thrown in hell, eternally burning, but to the inner liberation from the wheel of birth and death. It is the resurrection of the human being from the grave of nature, of which the Gospels testify, and which is represented in Arcanum 20 of the Hermetic Tarot. The essence of this consideration is aptly summarized in the following text by Jan van Eikenborg from his book The Confession of the Brotherhood of the Rosy Cross. Do you know what man's vocation is? Do you know of what he is capable? We are of God's lineage. We have been created in his image. Within us the divine spark glows. These are not cheap words, honeyed phrases spoken for your edification, but living flames of the eternal truth. You should free yourself of your limitations, of your spiritual slavery. You must become conscious of your own kingship. The mission of the Order of the Rosy Cross and its servants is to show the paths of liberation, for all are bowed under the yoke of slavery as regards body, soul, and consciousness. Something of a new holy yearning must enter into you, the holy need for liberation of which the Psalms sing. Something of the true knowledge of God must find a place within you, the daily walking with Christ. There are thousands of people who say they know Christ. They mouth his words with their lips, but their hearts remain unmoved and their minds do not understand him. And that is why the mission of the Order of the Rosy Cross is to tell you who, what, and how the Christ is. What this tremendous Sun Spirit desires for you, does for you, and wants from you. Not only the devout folding of your hands in prayer, not only the singing of a hymn, not the negative expectations that he will make everything right. No, you must do it for yourself. That is what is so tremendous about Christianity. The flames of the love of the Spirit must burst forth within you. The royal butterfly must break loose in you, so that you leave the pigsty and return to your father.